fourth of our lectures, the fourth and final lecture in our course on big business and the free market. We're determining whether these are friends or foes. We have so far talked about a couple of different things. We've talked about the nature of the firm. We've talked about the nature of the state. We talked about power and market, so the relationship between the firm and the state. And tonight, what we're going to do is we're going to talk specifically about these issues in the context of a major changing sector in the world, and that specifically is retail, which is kind of a new big growth sector in the American economy. So we're going to talk about a handful of things. First, we'll discuss very briefly the reasons why the retail sector itself has changed. We'll talk a little bit about brand equity and what brands do. What's the value of branding in light of some of the discussions that we had on Tuesday night. We'll speak briefly about executive compensation, because honestly, I think this is an interesting topic. And as we're talking about Walmart, I forget exactly how many Waltons are in the top 10 of the Forbes 400 now. I think it's 5 or 6 people with the last name Walton are in the top 10. Maybe it's 4. But a lot of people, a lot of Waltons are in the top 10 of the Forbes 400. And a lot of people are wondering, why is it that Walmart is so huge? Why is Walmart so big? Is it because they've done something bad? I'll summarize some of the research that I've done on Walmart. And if you want to send me an email, I can send you a zipped folder containing the published papers that I've written on Walmart. We will discuss, toward the end of our time together, subsidies and special privileges. We'll talk about commercial society, the tensions between commercial society and political society. We'll talk about the war on big business and the war on small firms and some of the issues that we discussed on Tuesday night. And then finally, we'll wrap it up by figuring out, excuse me, goodness, my apologies. Someone put on, apparently someone emailed Peter to ask if he was on cocaine during his lecture on Tuesday night. And so we had a hearty laugh about this, and I was actually watching Peter's lecture, and I think part of it is because of the video, his face sort of froze in a picture that made it look like he was, like he'd been, enjoying something. So I'm hoping that if my face is frozen, it's doing something more like this rather than, mid-sneeze as it was a second ago. But anyway, we'll wrap up by kind of talking about what we can learn about social science and the relationship between the market and the state by considering the retail sector very specifically. So with that, let's talk a little bit about retail, about major changes in the retail sector in the United States. It used to be that a lot of Americans earned their incomes by making stuff, turning cranks and cranking widgets at the widget factory. And, they would go and they'd put on their blue-collar shirt and they'd wear their hard hat and they'd punch a time clock and they'd go and they'd crank widgets for 40 hours a week and they would get paid. Things have changed, and the growing and innovative sector in the American economy is no longer manufacturing. It's actually now retail. Indeed, retail and distribution has been a major source of technological change and a major source of productivity growth in the American economy for the last several decades. The sources of technological change that have helped move this along have been, first of all, the rise of the automobile economy. So one of the reasons why we have superstores like Walmart and superstores like Costco and superstores like Target is because we built infrastructure around people driving cars from residential areas to retailers, loading those giant cars with stuff and then bringing all the stuff home and storing it at home. Let me pause on that for just a second because I think this is an interesting thing to think about. And again, I know that some of Peter's graduate students are in the audience. If you're looking for research topics and things of that nature, I think this might be worth looking into. There's some evidence to suggest that the rise of the modern retail economy is due to the expansion of transportation infrastructure, and I think that's certainly the case. Indeed, if you look online and find a video called The Story of Stuff and another video called The Story of Broke, it talks about building roads that go from the central city or that go from the suburb to and then dump you off right in front of Walmart or something to that effect. That's something that I think is worth looking into. Another thing that I think is worth looking into, and this kind of highlights the incremental nature of economic change, is I wonder if some of the costs of acquiring and storing, say, food today are reflected in one's mortgage or are reflected in one's housing costs rather than in the prices people pay at the supermarket. So, for example, you might be able to get a lot of really, really, really cheap stuff at Walmart, but then you're ultimately paying to store it yourself in a larger pantry, a larger refrigerator, a larger whatever that you have to be paying for. Anyway, my apologies. That's a bit of a digression. I think it's an interesting open question for anyone who's looking for a research topic. It's easy, though, to tell stories about economic history as if they're strictly stories about technological change. So one classic example of a story like this might be, James Watt unveiled his new steam engine, or Eli Whitney unveiled the cotton gin, and we woke up the next morning and it was the Industrial Revolution. You know, it's kind of like these technological discontinuities are the story of history. And there's a lot of work suggesting that's not necessarily the case. Indeed, a lot of the work that I do, following in the tradition of Douglas North, and a lot of the work that Peter does, following in the tradition of Oliver Williamson, is all about changes in organization. Particularly in the Northian tradition, changes in the organization of the firm, changes in the organization of societies, and changes in the organization of markets are among the things that help to explain the phenomena that we observe. Specifically, information itself is extremely costly. And another one of my mentors at Washington University in St. Louis, Sukho Kim, has written a couple of really interesting papers on change on the rise of the multi-unit firm in manufacturing and retailing in the 20th century. And his argument is it's not necessarily because of economies of scale as such, or economies of scale or economies of scope, as the business historian Alfred Chandler would have us believe, but rather the rise of multi-unit firms, specifically the rise of multi-unit retailers, comes from urbanization in the early 20th century, changing cost of information, and therefore rising returns to a brand name. So what did chains offer? What did big businesses offer to the world? And keep in mind, by the end of our time together this evening, we'll have discussed some of the things that make businesses big. Let's talk about some of the solid economic reasons, the market reasons, why big might be better. And note that when I say better, I don't mean better in the eyes of God. I mean better in the sense that this is what the market has selected. The market has selected for big firms like Walmart and Target rather than, you know, mom and pop's corner grocery shop or something like that. So we'll kind of pick up where we left off on Tuesday in our discussion of liability and the corporation. So there's a video that should be loaded up in the media viewer, and if you would, go ahead and click on the little circular replay button now and watch this. This is a FedEx delivery driver delivering a computer monitor. Now, interestingly, I'm assuming that everyone's watched the video at this point. Interestingly enough, this illustrates kind of precisely one of the issues that Peter raised in his lecture on Tuesday night. Specifically, you have someone acting on behalf of FedEx who comes along and is delivering someone's computer monitor. So he's responsible for the transfer of one person's private property from the manufacturer to the final consumer, and just chucks it over a fence. So on one hand, we get kind of precisely some of the information problems that some of the information problems and incentive problems that are created by firms. You know, in that the incentives of the firm to maximize profits may not necessarily be precisely aligned with the incentives of the driver, who just kind of wants to get his stuff done and get things finished as quickly as possible. And now he ends up in a YouTube video with millions and millions of views. Again, parenthetically, I think another interesting research topic would be, what is the rise of social media and the rise of things like YouTube mean for the market for information and for the ability of firms to exploit asymmetric information? I think basically that what's ultimately going to happen is markets are going to be much more efficient than they used to be as a result of the fact that now we have a FedEx truck, or we have a FedEx driver throwing a computer monitor over a fence, and now it's got millions and millions of YouTube views. So to explore kind of the point that I made on Tuesday, it's not necessarily clear that you want, and I'm assuming FedEx is a limited liability corporation. I'm a little bit skittish about that sometimes, because sometimes people refer to large firms like Koch Industries or Cargill as corporations. I've seen Koch Industries referred to, I think, as a corporation before. They're not. I don't think they're technically a corporation. They're held. They're private equity. But nonetheless, it's neither here nor there. In the case of FedEx, if I'm a shareholder in FedEx, you know, obviously I'm horrified by this, because you know, this suggests that my company is not doing what it should do. And if you're UPS or DHL or any of FedEx's competitors, you're delighted by this. Because, and in fact, I'm kind of surprised UPS hasn't made a response video showing one of their people delivering something very, 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 very carefully. It's not clear necessarily that FedEx should be legally liable for damage to the property, or if it should be the driver himself who should be legally liable. It's also not immediately clear that that's totally relevant, or that that's the right question to be asking. In the case of FedEx, this sends a video like this sends a very, very bad signal about their hiring decisions, and it says that maybe FedEx is not the careful company that everybody thought that they were. And if a pattern of behavior like this proceeds, if a pattern of behavior like this continues, then we should expect to see FedEx stock prices falling. And that is going to provide, you know, sort of regardless of who is legally liable, whether it's the delivery driver or the corporation, it's not exactly the same outcome. I don't necessarily know about the degree to which that's been explored, but again, I think it's something that's worth looking into. Pardon me. So what do retail chains offer, or what do chains offer very specifically? Brand names are themselves incredibly valuable. You know what you're going to get when you go into a Walmart, or when you go into a Hardee's, or when you go into a McDonald's, or something like that. If you see the golden arches on the horizon, you know that you're in for a meal that at the very least is probably going to be edible. My understanding is that, you know, before the rise of chains, a lot of times if you pull up at a gas station or a restaurant or something like that, you've got out-of-state license plates. Proprietors are never going to see you again. So they have incentive to shirk. They have incentive to try to take advantage of you. Now, if I pull it doesn't matter what state is listed on my license plate, when I pull into a McDonald's, the McDonald's corporation has an incentive to make sure that I have, at the very least, a pleasant, if not a pleasant experience, at least an experience that's good enough that I'm not going to tell my friends about how terrible it was. So brand equity itself really, really matters. Brands and chains and large firms are going to be able to solve these kinds of information problems in at much lower cost than can smaller outlets, smaller organizations, et cetera. In the case of big retailers like Walmart, you know pretty much if you need it, Walmart is going to have it. You don't know necessarily if mom and pop sandwich shop or mom and pop's corner grocery is going to have exactly what you're looking for. Most of the time, Walmart may not have the best version of it, but at the very least, you know that whatever you need, you can probably get it at Walmart. So in this sense, chains help to solve some of these information problems and help to make the market function more efficiently and more effectively than it otherwise would. My apologies. Okay, so let's think briefly about executive compensation. Why? And this is something that could be the subject of an entire course. Indeed, I know that I don't think that Peter's here right now, but I encourage him if he wants to offer a Mises Academy course on executive compensation. I think that would be very, very interesting. You have to ask these questions: why exactly it is that executives make so much money? Why do the top-level brass at places like Walmart make enormous amounts of money while people who stock Walmart don't. So there are a couple of reasons for this. First, the labor supply decisions of people who tend to have very, very high incomes are different from the labor supply decisions of people who tend to have very, very low incomes. This is not, it's not necessarily the case that every single person who earns more money works more and works harder than every single person who makes less money. And it's not necessarily the case that every single person who makes less money works less and doesn't work as hard as every single person who makes more money. But by and large, there's a very high correlation between the amount of time someone spends at work, the amount of time someone spends working, and their income. There's a direct correlation between the amount of time someone spends engaged in leisure and their income. More leisure implies lower income. More work implies higher income. So this is one of the reasons why people make, why some people make a lot of money and some people make relatively little money. Another reason for this is because to back up for just a second, there's an article that I just read by someone who's also a contributor to Forbes, pointing out that one of the differences between sort of top-tier executives and the rest of us is top-tier executives are constantly on call. Their life is work. And some of the comments on this said, well, you know, I'm not really sure that I believe this. You tell this to the police officer, the firefighter, or the single mom trying to work two jobs to make ends meet, that the reason that they make so much less than the executives is because they don't work as hard, or is because the executives are working so hard. I think this makes a fundamental economic mistake by ignoring the availability of substitutes. So one of the reasons why people who run large corporations in the United States make so much money relative to everybody else is there are not very many substitutes for their skills. So the pool of people who have the skills to run a Fortune 500 corporation, there are, I think, by definition, only 500 people who are qualified to be CEO of a Fortune 500 corporation, not just in the U.S., but in the world, out of a population of just over 7 billion. Now, this is a much smaller pool of people than the pool of people who are qualified to be Walmart greeters, to be grocery store clerks, to be police officers, firefighters, or soldiers. So another reason for this is just straightforward supply and demand. One of the reasons why executives make so much money while the rest of us don't is because they have skills for which there's a very, very, very high demand and for which there are not necessarily very many substitutes. So in our discussion of why we have big business and how it relates to the free market, to the extent that executive compensation is set by a market process, it by and large reflects the fact that there's very high demand for executive services and relatively little supply for the skill sets that would make one a very, very, very good executive. To put it lightly, being CEO of Walmart is more than just sitting around and cashing checks and ordering people around. You're talking about making decisions that could be life or death for some people and that are that might involve millions, if not billions of dollars. That might involve bankruptcy for some firms. That will ultimately involve major consequences for a lot of different people. Hence, this is one of the reasons why executives at top firms make the money that they do. Now, there's another interesting confusion in this discussion of executive compensation. Someone might say, well, why is it that a CEO of a company earns so much money if this company is losing money? So why might we be paying, say, $10 million a year to the CEO if the company's losing, you know, $1 billion every year? And I think the answer, again, to this is relatively straightforward. If it weren't for the intervention of the highly paid CEO, the losses would probably be a lot worse. So someone can still have a positive contribution to the bottom line, even if the company is running in the red. Now let's consider an analogy. Imagine that you've got a sinking ship, and you have a captain of a sinking ship. And the ship is going to sink, sort of no matter what, but the captain can intervene and make the ship sink sink more slowly than it otherwise would, and therefore allow for more lives to be saved, allow for more property to be recovered, and so on and so forth. The ship is going to sink, but the captain has, at the very least, done a valuable service in this sense. So even when a firm loses money, executives are probably still being paid according to their contribution to the firm's profitability, or fired for their contributions or lack thereof. All right, so let's talk about Walmart specifically. Now, why Walmart? I mean, why do I study Walmart? Written a number of papers about Walmart and done so with a couple of co-authors. And the story of how this developed as a research agenda, it gets back to a discussion I had the first semester I was teaching the introductory economics class at Rhodes. We were talking with students about why Walmart supported an increase in the minimum wage. And the reason for that is, as Peter talked about last time, well, you know, Walmart, they pay their workers something like $8 or $9 an hour. Why then might they support an increase in the minimum wage? The main reason for that is because while they pay $8 or $9 an hour, they compete with a lot of firms that don't. So they can raise their rivals' costs by supporting an increase in the minimum wage. Now, let's talk about what we might call the pillars of macroeconomics as they relate to Walmart.
Pardon me?
And we'll talk about how Walmart affects some of the big macroeconomic indicators that people care about, specifically employment, prices, and income. And then we'll talk about another measure of consumer welfare, which is selection. That's something that's a lot harder to capture in these discussions of employment, of prices, and of income. So, one of the reasons why people criticize Walmart is that they come in and allegedly they destroy mom and pop and they wipe out all of the jobs. Costco comes in and wipes out all the jobs. Target comes in and wipes out all the jobs. Big retailers come in and they then become monopolists in the markets for goods, and they become monopsonists in the markets for labor. And therefore they exploit everybody and they make everybody worse off. I was up very early yesterday morning, actually, and there's a link to this on the course website. I did a very, very short radio appearance for a CBC station in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, to talk about how the new Costco would affect the market in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada. I've never in my life been to Fredericton. In fact, I think my experience in Canada is a handful of trips to Toronto. I look forward to going back, but I've never been there. Nonetheless, given what I know about retail, I can probably say a few things about how that's going to affect the local market and how it's going to affect the national market and the international market for labor, the national and international markets for goods, and the national and international markets for technologies and services. At the local level, Annette Basker was the first, she's at the University of Missouri, she's actually one of Professor Klein's colleagues, she was the first to systematically estimate the effect of Walmart entry on local labor markets, and she found that at the county level, each new Walmart led to about 50 new jobs in the long run in the retail sector, and this was offset by a reduction of about 20 jobs in the wholesale sector, because Walmart can vertically integrate. They can do a couple of different things. People who have followed up on this have found that some of these estimates may not hold up quite that well to alternative specifications. In a follow-up study, David Newmark and some of his co-authors have estimated that each new Walmart job displaces about 1.4 jobs that would otherwise exist in retail. In other words, between 1961 and 2004, there was a 271% increase in retail employment, whereas there would have been a 279% increase in retail employment were it not for the existence of Walmart. But they're careful to note that this basically means that there's probably not a big net change in overall employment. Retail employment might shrink relative to what it would have been in the absence of Walmart, but Walmart probably doesn't systematically destroy job opportunities overall. Another paper that's come out in the last couple of years by John Haltewanger and a couple of his co-authors argue that there is actually lower growth in employment and lower growth, I believe, in sales for firms that compete. I'm not sure about sales, but I think there's actually lower growth in employment for firms that compete with big box retailers like Walmart, Target, Costco, et cetera, but that's only when they're in the same narrowly defined business sector and in the same very narrow geographic region. And they do this, they come up with these estimates for the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. And they find that basically there are going to be negative effects for firms that are in very, very narrow sectors that compete with Walmart, Target, Costco, Target, et cetera. Well, to make a long story short, if you sell hammers and Home Depot opens next door, then you're probably not long for this world. But if you sell something that could be complements to hammers, or if you sell fancy chocolates or something like that, and Home Depot opens next door, it's probably not really going to affect you that much, and indeed it might actually help. There's some evidence that this is the case. In a paper that was published in 2008, Russell Sobel and one of his co-authors at West Virginia University, they used state-level data to analyze an important aspect of the Walmart effect and an important aspect of Walmart's contribution to creative destruction. So it might be the case that Walmart affects one local labor market, but there are spillovers into other labor markets and spillovers into other industries at the non-local level that are not going to get captured by studies that look just at city-level or county-level data. So their motivation for using state-level data might be something like, and again, they're at West Virginia University. So if you know anything about West Virginia, people do a lot of whitewater rafting in West Virginia. So it might be the case that a Walmart opens up in Morgantown, which is where West Virginia University is. And maybe some businesses go under in Morgantown, but people use this extra income, or they use the extra money in their pockets because their dollars are going further, to go and take more rafting trips on the New River or the Gauley River or something like that in West Virginia. So this might close doors in some areas and in some industries. It might open doors in other areas and in other industries. And they find, basically, by looking at Walmart, that there's no detectable effect, statistically, of Walmart on small businesses in the United States using, again, state-level data. And they define small businesses, according to data they get, I believe, from the Census Bureau, as firms and establishments with 1 to 4 employees or 5 to 9 employees. They look at bankruptcy rates for small businesses, I think. They look at the self-employment rate and things like that. They find Walmart just does not really seem to matter that much for purposes of employment. Now, Walmart really matters a lot, and Costco really matters a lot, and Target really matters a lot when we're talking about things like prices. So Super Walmart, for example, has about, a 10% price advantage over its competitors, and there's a spillover effect on prices consistent with about a 1 to 1.2% reduction in competitors' prices for groceries when Super Walmart opens up. Again, this is other research that Emmett Basker has done, in this case with an economist named Michael Knoll. Now, one thing that's interesting about this is the biggest effects on prices are for stores that primarily serve low-income consumers. So the effect of Walmart on prices is not just, grocery prices specifically, is not just substantial, it's also progressively distributed. The major beneficiaries of Walmart's lower prices are going to be primarily the poor. This is consistent with estimates from Jerry Hausman and Ephraim Leibtag, who have studied the effect of Walmart, Costco, Target, et cetera. They lump on it. When they say Walmart, they sort of lump in all of these big box retailers, of which Walmart is sort of the dominant example. They find that there's about a 0.32 to 0.42 percentage point overstatement in the Urban Consumer Price Index for food. This is strictly from things like supercenters and big box stores and things of that nature. So we're actually overstating the rate of inflation in food prices as a result of the fact, according to Hausman and Leibtag, that we're not adequately accounting for the effect of Walmart, Costco, Sam's Club, Target, Kmart, etc. Hausman and Leibtag elsewhere estimate that the additional well-being associated with access to firms like Walmart, Costco, Target, Sam's Club, Kmart, etc., is called compensating variation, is equal to roughly 25% of food expenditure. So in other words, to make me as well off in a world without Walmart, Costco, Target, etc., as I was in a world with these firms, what I would need is you need to compensate me with about 25% of what I spend on food every year in order to make me as well off as I was in a world that had all of these firms. Now, this is one of the reasons why the economist Jason Furman, who either was, or I think still is maybe, an advisor to Barack Obama, calls Walmart a progressive success story. He says, you know, we have these reductions in food prices as a result of the fact that we have Walmart. And these are going to be, again, progressively distributed because the people who spend the biggest chunks of their income on food are going to be primarily the poor. So low-income consumers are the ones who spend the biggest chunks of their income on food. Therefore, they're the ones who are the biggest beneficiaries of Walmart's effect on food prices. Let's see. Let's think about income for just a second. Think about how Walmart affects poverty, how Walmart affects people's ability to consume goods and services. There is an estimate suggesting that Walmart entry is associated with a slight increase in the county poverty rate. My co-author and I are looking, we have looked in the past at ways we might be able to re-examine that. So I'm hoping we can reopen that research before too terribly long. But the economist Richard Vedder and his co-author Wendell Cox, in a book that was published several years ago called The Walmart Revolution, and Richard Vedder is a name that might be familiar to some of you. He's spoken at a number of Mises events. They estimate that the social saving from big box retail is equal to approximately 5% of U.S. gross domestic product. So in other words, GDP is 5% higher than it would have been in the absence of big box retail. For perspective, this estimate is equal roughly to the effect of railroads on the American economy in the 19th century. So Vedder and Cox say that the rise of big box retail, Walmart, Home Depot, Costco, Kmart, etc., is one of the greatest forces, and I'm paraphrasing here, one of the greatest forces for improvement and well-being in American economic history. A handful of authors at the University of California at Berkeley have estimated that Walmart leads to a reduction in wages in the retail sector. So they estimate that it was for the year 2000, depending on which version of the paper you read, either $4.5 or $4.7 billion in lower retail wages as a result of Walmart. But the big problem, the thing that matters is not necessarily the size of the number on our paycheck, but what those dollars will buy. And given Walmart's effect on prices, given Walmart's effect on selection and things like that, the effect is pretty unambiguous. If you use a number derived by a firm called Global Insight in a study that actually Walmart funded from a number of years ago, they estimated that Walmart saves the average household $2,329 per year. You get an increase in well-being of $263 billion, okay, which is way, way, way bigger than $4.7 billion in lost retail wages. Now, granted, that's a Walmart-funded study, so you might want to take that with a grain of salt. It was overseen by an independent panel, but again, you know, some people might not trust it. In a back-of-the-envelope exercise that my co-author Charles Cornemanch and I did as part of our study of the relationship between Walmart and obesity, we estimated that in the year 2002, Super Walmart alone, so just Walmart supercenters, which are the ones that sell both groceries and like clothes and TVs and toys and stuff like that, just Walmart supercenters save the average household $177. Okay, you multiply this times the number of households that were in the U.S. Census in the year 2000, and you get a ballpark estimate of about $18.7 billion. So using just the effect of Super Walmart on household savings, you get about a net increase of well-being of, say, savings minus the reduction in retail wages of at least $14 billion spread out across the American economy. Okay. So once again, for a lot of different reasons, people think that Walmart is a progressive success story, or we've estimated how Walmart affects labor markets and found it doesn't really matter that much. We found that Walmart raises incomes, and we found that Walmart saves us a lot of money. Saves us a lot of real resources. Now, there are hard-to-measure things that matter as well, other aspects of material well-being that aren't going to be captured in things like the unemployment rate, the consumer price index, and gross domestic product. So consider selection, for example. In a brand new paper that just appeared in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, a scholar has estimated that Walmart entry is associated with reductions in the frequency with which stores experience stockouts. So competing stores after Walmart enters are going to be less likely to run out of stuff, less likely to run out of inventory, as a result specifically of the fact that they face a lot of competitive pressure. And again, the major beneficiaries of this are going to be the poor, because the biggest effects are on stores that serve, again, primarily poor people. Okay? So when we talk about the effect of Walmart, it's positive on a lot of different margins. Naturally, this is a point in the discussion in which someone says, well, okay, this is true, but man doesn't live on bread alone. You know, whether the bread is cheap or whether someone is employed in making the bread or whether the bread is actually available even on the shelves, there's a lot of non-economic stuff that matters, like relationships, like what's called social capital, like individual values, like culture. And this has been sort of the thrust of my research agenda on Walmart. We've been looking at the social effects of Walmart, and we think this is kind of a proxy for the social effects of capitalism and the social effects of big business. We look at how Walmart affects social capital, how Walmart affects individual values, and how Walmart affects culture. So let's consider what we mean by social capital. Social capital is a couple of different things. It's both an input into production, and it's an output. It can be a consumer good. So Robert Putnam, in a 2000 book called Bowling Alone, writes that whereas physical capital refers to physical objects and human capital refers to properties of individuals, social capital refers to connections among individuals, social networks, and the norms of reciprocity that arise from them. So social capital consists basically of relationships. These are useful as both an input into entrepreneurship and an input into the business environment. So having good relationships is going to make you more productive. It's going to give you more access to the business world, and it's probably going to increase your incomes. So social capital is important for a well-functioning economic system. It's also important because there's a lot of stuff that matters that's more important than money. Time with your family, time with your kids, time with your neighbors, time with your friends. This all matters as well. And this is something that we studied because, first, we got interested in it. And then second, we discovered in the process of doing the research, there are some claims, some empirical claims, that Walmart actually reduces social capital. Okay, so you should have access to the video that's on YouTube of me speaking about this at Middle Tennessee State University, so I'm not going to go into any of this in detail. But we look at how Walmart affects things like participation in team sports, frequency with which people play cards, how often you go to club meetings, whether you do volunteer work, things like that. And we find that Walmart just doesn't really matter that much. I'm going to skip a couple of slides there and say that, you know, for the most part, on almost all of these sort of non-economic measures of the meaning of life, Walmart just does not really matter that much. I'm going to pause again and offer another research suggestion. One thing that we do, and in fact, I'll go back a slide or two. So in a handful of specifications, we find that Walmart actually reduces the voter turnout rate, to which a lot of people might say, well, okay, it's clear that Walmart is destroying democracy. So you might hear people talk about statistically significant versus economically significant results. And we found that the reduction in voter turnout is statistically significant, which means that we're pretty sure it's not zero based on the data. However, it's not necessarily the case that it is economically significant. You know, a 0.7% reduction in voter turnout in one set of specifications with instrumental variables estimates going in the opposite direction, okay, yeah. It's not really clear that we have a big, big, big story. Now, what's missing from this slide, a story we could tell, is we can ask whether that is socially significant. Because it's not clear necessarily that voting is per se an expression of social virtue, that voting is per se a way of discharging one's obligations in a civil society. I'm reasonably certain that Professor Klein argues that, there are a lot of things you can do besides voting that are ways to be good and virtuous human beings. I just finished reviewing a book that some of you might find interesting by a philosopher named Jason Brennan called The Ethics of Voting, in which he argues that there are a lot of ways besides voting that you can make the world a better place, and a lot of different ways besides voting that you can discharge a civic duty, assuming that you have one. Now, we also look at values, and so some people have argued that firms like Walmart exert undue influence on the culture. From the left, Walmart is derided as a conservative cultural gatekeeper because there are some things you just can't get at Walmart. There are certain CDs you can't get, certain magazines, etc. And then from the right, Walmart was derided for joining the National Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce several years ago. So what we wanted to do is look at the data again and see how Walmart affects different measures of individual values. So we asked, how does Walmart affect whether people believe that marijuana should be legalized? The frequency with which people go to church, the frequency with which people go to bars, people's views on same-sex marriage. And once again, we found the answer is, yeah, not hardly at all. There's basically no effect of Walmart on most of these measures of values. So Walmart is probably economically beneficial or narrowly financially beneficial or materially beneficial while being socially neutral. We did find one effect that would have been kind of fun to run with in the popular media, but that nonetheless kind of illustrates some of the pitfalls of empirical research and the overuse or the abuse of statistical significance. So we can use statistics, we can use data to help explain things and to say, well, what was historically the effect of X on Y? Okay, probably if we repeat these precise conditions, then that's what the effect of X on Y is going to be. Now we found using 1 year of data on the frequency with which people rent X-rated movies that Walmart actually reduces the frequency with which people rent porn. And so again, if we wanted to be sort of really partisan and splashy about this, we'd say, oh, well, clearly Walmart is reducing the frequency with which people are renting pornography. And when you control for state effects, the effect actually is larger. The problem, though, is we're reasonably certain that would be a case of confusing correlation with causation. Now, we can correct for this in a lot of different ways, but since we only had 1 year of data in our discussion of Walmart and porn, we're pretty sure that what's happening here is that there is, in fact, there's some third factor, say like conservatism of an area, that's predicting both a low frequency with which people are renting porn and a high probability that Walmart is entering. So that's one of those things that we thought might have been interesting, but again, not so much. Culture. What about culture? Is Walmart, and by extension capitalism and big business, affecting our cultural output and our cultural intake? Is it making us more, or cultured or less cultured? In other words, if you're a Simpsons fan, are we going to see Rainier Wolf Castle in the new McBain movie? Or are we going to the legitimate theater to watch Troy McClure in a musical about the Planet of the Apes? Well, again, we looked at the data, and we found that Walmart does increase the frequency with which you do stuff for which you can get the inputs at Walmart. Walmart also, there's some evidence to suggest that Walmart increases the frequency with which you do some high culture activities. So when you do some high culture activities like visiting art galleries or going to classical music concerts and things like that, this actually might increase as a result of Walmart's presence, and we think this is primarily due to the fact that Walmart lowers prices, Walmart makes people's dollars go further, and therefore they might therefore have more dollars with which they can do some of these high culture things. What else have we done? Well, we've looked to see how people respond to incentives, and we looked at how Super Walmart affects obesity in the United States. And this is probably our most and best publicized paper on this, because everyone has an opinion about Walmart and everyone has an opinion about obesity. We find that lower prices attributable to Super Walmart probably increase obesity. Why? Because as food gets cheaper, people eat more of it. As people eat more food, they probably gain more weight. We find that you can explain about 10.5% of the increase in obesity since the late 1980s strictly in terms of the expansion of Super Walmart. Again, however, if you look at how much the average household saves as a result of access to Super Walmart, the average household enjoys about $177 a year in 2002, in savings strictly due to the price effects of Super Walmart. Of that, only about 5.6% of that $177 is offset by higher obesity costs. So this actually represents what I think could be an interesting way in which research can get misinterpreted. Some people might pick this up and run with it and say, well, hey, Walmart is increasing obesity, therefore Walmart is terrible and awful and evil and bad. But, you know, again, we have to compare cost to benefits here. And assuming away anything having to do with libertarian theory, if we just wanted to compare financial cost to financial benefits, opposing Walmart on the basis of an increase in obesity would be cutting off your nose to spite your face, or you're trying to lose weight by cutting off your nose, so to speak. First of all, the reduction is probably going to be trivial. It's probably going to be relatively small. And second, the costs are going to be astronomical. In our most recent work, we're looking at how firms compete with each other in the retail sector. We're looking at how warehouse clubs cause firms to change their behavior, how warehouse clubs cause grocery stores to change their pricing behavior. And specifically, we're looking at Costco. Why? Because Costco has emerged as kind of an interesting story here. Because firms compete with each other on the basis of a lot of things, price and quantity, but they also compete on the basis of quality, and not just on the basis of quality of the products on offer, but on the quality of the overall shopping experience. So what we find is that there's about a 2.7% increase in incumbent grocery prices after a new Costco enters, after we control for the presence of a Super Walmart, the presence of a Sam's Club, and Sam's Club doesn't seem to matter for grocery prices, and a bunch of other different things. We actually find that firms increase their grocery prices after Costco enters. Unfortunately and tragically, this was interpreted by a blogger for Time Magazine as a claim that Costco is to blame for inflation. That's absolutely not the case. Why, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. What we think is going on, we also don't think this is an exception to the law of demand. We think that what's going on is that firms are competing with Costco not necessarily by cutting prices, but by raising quality. And there's a little bit of evidence to suggest this is the case. Probably the low quality firms might exit. Again, we don't know that necessarily, but we find that the effect is actually larger for non-branded items like produce and things like that. So we think that firms might be competing with Costco by increasing quality rather than by reducing price. So they might actually be changing their business model altogether, rather than just cutting prices in the face of Costco entry or something like that. Now, what about subsidies and special privileges? Commercial society and political society. The sociologist Franz Oppenheimer describes what he called the economic means and the political means to wealth. And I think Peter talked about this a little bit on Tuesday night. The economic means to wealth are production and exchange. You increase others' opportunities, you increase wealth, you make yourself rich, everybody gets richer, everybody's better off as a result of all of this. The political means to wealth are expropriation and redistribution, taking things that don't belong to you. In the first case, when we have commercial society, when people are getting rich by not expropriating and redistributing, but by producing and exchanging, everybody gets rich, everybody's better off as a result. In the second case, you have people expending resources in order to get a fixed, pie. So imagine, if you will, two kids fighting over a piece of bubble gum, or something like that. There's one piece of bubble gum that two kids like literally end up in a fist fight over it. They end up expending resources, the energy it takes to throw punches, the energy it takes to absorb punches, spit, blood, maybe a couple of teeth or something like that. All of this in order to get their hands on a piece of bubble gum. Not to produce more gum, but just to get an already existing piece of gum. The second case, political society, this is extremely wasteful. For the most part, Walmart and firms like that, I think, are participants in commercial society. It is true that Walmart benefits from subsidies, and there are a lot of organizations, a lot of anti-Walmart organizations, that have detailed some of the subsidies that Walmart has gotten, but I think a lion's share of Walmart's business, the lion's share of business being done by firms like this, is almost wholly commercial. It's almost wholly production, exchange, innovation, finding newer and better ways to deliver products to people, and in large part responding to the incentives that happen to be in place. Now, this is the case for firms like Walmart, firms like McDonald's, firms probably like Kroger, the grocery store that I shop at. It is not necessarily the case. Firms like Archer Daniels Midland, which get enormous government subsidies for the production of agricultural goods, and it's also, again, probably not the case for firms like Goldman Sachs. That again, I think Peter might have discussed this the other day, and I know a handful of other people have said, well, Goldman Sachs, in a sense, they're almost another branch of the government now. When you look at their relationship to the state itself. It is true, and again, this is something that Peter discussed on Tuesday, that big business gets lots of privileges, but small businesses get a lot of privileges as well. And one thing that I think is kind of an open issue in terms of our discussion of changes in the retail sector in the United States in the 20th century is whether is sort of the role of ideological change. Because for the 19th century and a good chunk of the early 20th century, there was enormous populist political opposition to the rise of big businesses. Specifically, the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, or the A&P, expanded all across the country, and everyone thought this was terrible. Everyone thought it was awful. Indeed, there were high school and college debate tournaments or debate topics on whether chain stores were good for America or bad for America. There was a big war on big, a war on big business, a war on big chains that got an awful lot of populists, and a lot of them primarily in the South, exercised over this alleged corruption of youth, over money leaving the local community and going to the big chain in New York or Chicago or somewhere like that. There was a lot of political pressure to restrict the operations of big businesses, big firms, and big chains. In large part, you know, should be fairly easy to explain, because mom and pop probably vote in the local community. They're probably members of the local chamber of commerce, and they vote. You know, mom and pop, if they own a store in Louisiana, they probably vote. While the board of directors of A&P or Sears or Walmart, you know, if they're not in Louisiana, they probably don't vote. So it's the advantage of politicians, probably, to appeal to populism and launch kind of a war on big business or a war on big chains. One of my colleagues here at Rhodes, Stephanie Masali, is an accounting historian, and she and one of her mentors have a neat paper that was in a journal called State Tax Notes, and I think you can find this online now, but it talks about the use of anti-chain legislation in Mississippi. Or it talks about changes in retail taxes in Mississippi that were aimed at punishing potential competitors for small businesses. So for the most part, a lot of the it's not immediately clear a priori whether the major beneficiaries of state intervention are big businesses or small businesses primarily. Because yeah, it could very well be the case that Walmart has access to a lot of political influence. But small merchants have access to a lot of political influence, again, probably at different levels than Walmart does. And I think this all represents untilled ground in terms of research and empirical political economy. I don't know what the answers are. And again, I think if there are graduate students out there who are looking for dissertation topics, I would suggest doing a bit of fancy scribbling. Feel free to send me an email and get to work. Okay. Now, I mentioned in the little video that I did on chain stores that a wise man once said, "Don't hate the player, hate the game." And this is, I don't hold any like special love for Walmart or Costco or Target or anything like that. I mean, I think it's interesting when you go in because you look around and see what human potential can accomplish. And indeed, one thing that I like Walmart for the same reason I like Las Vegas, or I like going into any grocery store, any retail outlet, for the same reason I like going to Las Vegas. It is true that these are the result primarily of government, these are dependent in some sense on government intervention. So Las Vegas probably wouldn't exist in its current form were it not for government subsidies to water and all sorts of different types of government intervention. But what all this represents is a lower bound on how great life can be and a lower bound on how great the world could be if we got rid of the government. if we got rid of government intervention that distorts the pattern of production and that distorts the pattern of retail trade. So, given that I like retail, given that I like, again, like I said, no, I don't have any special love for Walmart as such or special love for Kroger as such, yeah, I happen to like living in a modern, wealthy, capitalist society. I think about how much better things could be. What do we have that would be so much better than Walmart, Costco, Target, Kroger, et cetera, if we were to scale back government intervention? But a lot of firms like Walmart, and a lot of firms like Target, and a lot of firms like Costco are playing a political game that they probably didn't want to play to begin with. Again, like I said on Tuesday, Sam Walton was derided for his arrogance because he didn't want to play the Washington lobbying game. He wanted to focus on what he did best, which was delivering goods of reasonable quality at very, very low prices to people who would probably not have been able to afford them before. Naturally, when a firm starts to get big, they start to attract a lot of attention. Like I said the other night, Walmart, you know, no one cared about Walmart when Walmart was little. Okay. But when Walmart started to grow, when Walmart became a potential source of tax revenue and a potential source of campaign contributions, Walmart then became an integral part, an integral player in the rent-seeking society. Now, again, I'm not a moral philosopher, so I can't really speak to the rectitude of things like this. But to the degree that Walmart and firms like Walmart are involved in a political game, it's because their very survival almost depends on it. What I have here is a picture taken from the Wall Street Journal last summer, and this was sent to me by a former colleague. And he pointed out that there's actually a firm, and this is when we talk about the waste or the dissipation of rents in a political society, there's actually a company that exists for the purpose of basically stirring up, quote, allegedly grassroots, these are in fact actually AstroTurf campaigns, against new Walmarts. So, for example, suppose that I owned a grocery store, or I owned a small chain of grocery stores in Memphis, and Walmart was going to expand. Excuse me. I might hire this company to send in a couple of people to engage in black ops, to come in under perhaps an assumed identity or something like that, and start sort of raising a ruckus about why we need to prevent Walmart from entering the community or prevent Walmart from expanding, or something like that. So one of the things this illustrates is sort of not just the financial and economic bankruptcy, but the moral bankruptcy of the political game. It's very easy to say, well, the only way to win is not to play. But the incentives to play are almost completely overwhelming. I borrow a thesis from Don Woodrow, blogger at Cafe Hayek, economics professor at George Mason University. I remember several years ago he wrote, he predicted that someday when Walmart goes out of business, and make no mistake, someday Walmart will go out of business, all is equal, people would look back, the same kinds of commentators who lament the rise of the Walmart economy or who lament the rise of big business will look back and say, oh, what has the American economy come to that even Walmart has gone out of business? I mean, I remember when you go to Walmart and they had everything. You know, Walmart had anything you could possibly want, and you'd run into your neighbors at Walmart, or maybe you're able to get in and get out and not even have to worry necessarily about having a conversation with somebody. So if you'd had a bad day, you could just go to Walmart and shop anonymously and get out of there. What does the world come to? We don't have Walmart anymore. All sorts of different firms right now, Amazon probably is near the top of this list, are working day and night to find ways to beat Walmart at their own game. This is from Shelley's poem, Ozymandias. Look at my works, ye mighty, in despair. And it's this statue that suffice it to say, has not stood the test of time particularly well. So I think a lot of the fear about Walmart and a lot of the fear about big business, so to speak, is way overblown. Why? Well, because Walmart looks great now. They're doing very, 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 very well. For a lot of people, it is inconceivable that Walmart might run into financial trouble. A lot of people felt that way about General Motors in the 1950s, the 1960s, and parts of the 1970s. And lo and behold, if it were not for massive government bailouts and massive government protections, General Motors probably would not exist today. At the very least, it certainly wouldn't exist in its present form. So people ask about the kind of society that we want to create. They say, well, what kind of society do we want to create? And I think this is sort of almost the last refuge of a rhetorical scoundrel, is to say, okay, well, look, so Walmart is great on all these margins, or this firm is great on all these margins, or capitalism and free markets are great on all these margins, but what kind of society do we want to create? I think one of the major contributions of the Austrian school, and specifically of Mises and Hayek, to the socialist calculation debate is to say that as economic systems go, capitalism is really the only thing that's possible. Socialism is impossible. This kind of society that we want to create is one that, given the constraints of human nature, given the constraints of scarcity, is literally going to be impossible. So I'm thinking about this relationship between big business and the marketplace. Are they friends or are they foes? Well, honestly, I think the jury is still out on that a little bit. I think it's very, very easy to sort of jump on the anti-corporate bandwagon or to rail against big business. And indeed, I've written articles that are critical of Walmart and critical of all sorts of businesses and critical of the use of special privilege. But I think it's important not to throw the capitalist baby out with the interventionist bathwater. For the most part, major corporations like Walmart, like Target, like Costco, like Yum! Brands, which owns Taco Bell and things like that, they are not making their money by redistributing resources from the poor to the rich. They're not making their money by stealing, necessarily. For the most part, Walmart makes its money by providing goods that people want at prices they're willing to pay and finding newer and better ways to do that. So with that, I see that Peter has now joined the panel. I'm happy to open things up for chat and discussion. Peter, feel free to jump in whenever you would like to. Let's go to the Q&A. Okay, James P. would love a course on executive compensation. Great topic. Peter Klein, I'm looking at your general direction here. Let's see here.
Sign me up.
Hey, all right. Excellent. Let's see. Are there more sources of information? Okay, so Steve Wise, are there more sources of information on the concept of brand equity? Cambodia thrives on tourism dollars, and the local business owners tend to treat customers as one-time visitors who should be fleeced as thoroughly as possible. Minimal customer service. Okay, so sources of information on the concept of brand equity. So that's interesting. I've written a thing or two about that. One of my examples comes from Virginia Postrel's book, Not the Substance of Style, The Future and Its Enemies. It talks about these kinds of things. Now, so you mentioned being fleeced. Send me an email, art.cardin@gmail.com, and I'll send you a copy of a paper that I published in the Southern Journal of Entrepreneurship that has some sources in the bibliography about some firms that started in Memphis specifically. Let me speak specifically of a couple of these examples. One is Holiday Inn. So Holiday Inn was started by Kemmons Wilson in Memphis, and indeed the reason why he started Holiday Inn is because on an automobile trip he noticed he was getting fleeced by almost every hotel that he and his family stopped at, and he thought, well, look, there's a market for a reputable branded hotel chain that solves some of these information problems. Cambodia, I have the Economic Freedom of the World Index, this was a couple of years ago. I actually have a poster on my wall, so let me see where Cambodia is on this list. It'll take me too long to find it, but I'm sure that with Google you can find out where Cambodia is on the Economic Freedom of the World Index. This is a great question about countries like Cambodia that might rely on tourist dollars, or Mexico that gets a lot of tourist money, and things like that. I know a lot of people have written critically of what they call cruise ship economies, but I think these are markets that are still very much in flux, and I think it's something that should be studied and studied in much in much greater detail. In the case of cruise ship economies, I know we've taken a couple of cruises as family vacations, and I know that often, like on the boat, they'll have places. They'll say, okay, you're going to get off in whatever place in Mexico or whatever place in wherever, and here are all the places that are like that are certified by us as a as reputable places to go. If you go outside this little area, or if you go to a place that's not on this little map, then you're completely on your own. So. So I think in this case, first there's a lot of research to be done, exploring and explaining these kind of tourist economies and the market institutions that develop. In the case of Cambodia, I think, again, I know very little about Cambodia, but I think in a lot of these places we're observing almost sort of the birth pangs of commercial society. Indeed, actually, this is one thing that is great about free market capitalism is we actually get less fleecing, less cheating, and more trust as a result of the institutions of the market economy. Okay, this goes to this sets up James Key's question: how does the Chamber of Commerce fit into the landscape? I get the sense that the National Chamber of Commerce is a tool for interventionism, but the local Chamber of Commerce is more of a voice for freedom and small business. What's your thinking? Okay, so that I don't necessarily know. I don't know that the National Chamber of Commerce is a tool for interventionism or that small Chamber of Commerce is our voices for freedom and small business. That's I'm almost completely ignorant there. I can tell plausible stories in either direction. But I can see where local chambers of commerce. I can see there being maybe more direct rent seeking at the local level with these chambers of commerce, even though this is probably a powerful competitive check. Say in the case of, so you've got the Memphis Chamber of Commerce and then the Nashville Chamber of Commerce. They're competing maybe to attract businesses or something to that effect. Again, I think an underexplored issue in these discussions of local political economy is how exactly does a firm like a Walmart get approved? You know, when Walmart wants to open up, how are they able to get everybody to say yes to Walmart opening up, given that there's potential rent-seeking opposition? And one thing that I've wondered, and again, I think this is something someone should explore, graduate students, there's work to be done here. When you go into a Walmart or a Costco or any big firm, one of the things that they'll advertise very prominently is the amount of money they give to local organizations. Now, first, I wonder what these local organizations are doing. So what is their purpose? Do they actually do anything benevolent, or they just have nice dinners to raise money or something like that? And then second, I wonder how many local, what the relationship between these civic organizations to which firms like Walmart is giving money is with local power brokers. So for example, you know, I would not be surprised, I have no idea whether it's true or not, but if Walmart gives, say, like $50,000 to the local Sisters of the Poor charity, I would not be surprised if it just so happens that everybody who constitutes the board of directors of the Sisters of the Poor charity, if these people also have to be married to everybody, married to the people who are on the city council that have to approve Walmart's application for a zoning variance or something to that effect. Again, this is something that I think is worth exploring, but right now, currently, completely underexplored. Let's see here. Okay, are the slides available? They should be. I haven't emailed them to Doug yet. I need to do that. So let's see here. So let me look for some questions in the chat window, and then I've got another in the Q&A. Okay, Sarbanes. Okay, Kathy Cuthbert says that the the size of it, Sarbanes-Oxley might have made the pool of executives even smaller. Well, you were almost certainly correct, given that Sarbanes-Oxley imposed like criminal penalties for people signing fraudulent financial statements. This makes it more risky to be an executive. Let's see here. Okay, so what is the damage to society when multinationals stage or help staging coups in foreign countries? Well, again, I'm not really sure what the empirical evidence is on the specific damage done to specific societies when multinational corporations help to stage coups and things like that. I have to wonder sometimes what the coup would be for. I've done a little bit of work on Chile and a little bit of work on the relationship between economic freedom and human rights abuses. And I've found actually that contra the claims made by Naomi Klein in her book, The Shock Doctrine, Naomi Klein, who's obviously the older sister of our very own Peter Klein. Contrary to her claim,
sorry, Art, I'm looking for the barf icon.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. So Peter Klein and Naomi Klein are not, in fact, actually related. Contra her story, places that abuse human rights tend to actually have slower rates of economic liberalization. Okay, so the damage done to societies when multinational stage or help staging coups in foreign countries. What's interesting here, I think both rhetorically and also from a scholarly perspective, is that often people will look at the relationship between a corporation and a government and will think that it is the corporation that is corrupting the government and that it's the profit motive that is corrupting civic virtue. I think it's absolutely backwards. I think it's government corrupts corporations, or government corrupts commerce, and it is not civic virtue, but civic vice that corrupts commerce and that corrupts the profit motive. So in other words, money doesn't corrupt politics, it's politics that corrupts money. Short answer, I don't know enough about the empirical literature about the relationship between multinationals and foreign governments and coups and things like that. I think it's worth exploring, and in fact, actually, another idea for a paper that I've kind of kicked around a little bit is to look at the relationship. It's to look at human rights monitoring. In fact, let me settle on this for just a second. To look at human rights monitoring by companies like Walmart, because this is a big issue. A lot of the countries from which Walmart sources goods do not have particularly good human rights records and do not have particularly good economic institutions. Once again, I think it's important to note that the abuses that take place in sweatshops in Asian countries and Latin American countries and places like that, this is due to lousy political institutions, not due to the avarice of profit-seeking firms like Walmart. But nonetheless, I would be very interested in looking at the relationship between, so empirically, the relationship between between economic freedom and sourcing operations for American corporations. So while there are a lot of countries with very, very low wages and lousy economic freedom scores, among countries that are low wage, my guess would be more economic freedom would be associated with a higher probability of Walmart sourcing stuff from your country, and furthermore, probably more human rights protection. From a theoretical perspective, or indeed even possibly from a philosophical perspective, I've wondered about the degree to which you might actually be in dereliction of duty if you abuse human rights as a corporate executive. Because if you abuse human rights, and when I talk about abusing human rights, I'm not talking about like paying people less than a lot of American college students think that people in the third world should be paid. I'm talking about things like actual slavery and fraud and whatnot. By engaging in slavery and fraud, you're possibly exposing your firm to liability. and possibly therefore therefore failing to act in the best interest of your shareholders, and indeed acting perhaps in dereliction of your fiduciary duty. So if you engage in potentially short-run profitable acts that expose your firm to liability for slavery, fraud, etc., that could work to the detriment, the long-run detriment of the firm. One, that should provide a fairly powerful check on abuses of human rights by corporations or abuses that take place in relatively poor countries. And given it, even if it doesn't, we have to look for the institutional mechanisms that prevent it. Again, though, I think this is one of these questions that is interesting, and it'd be great if it was answered. But right now, the state of the knowledge is just that we don't know what the answer is. Have something in the chat window. A friend worked at Home Depot as a merchandiser and spent a lot of time traveling to factories in other countries to verify the human rights atmosphere. Okay, this is interesting. They have the incentive to not get caught contracting with abusive factories. So we could say that these corporations improve the human rights in other countries. Okay, so this is interesting. So first of all, that's very, very useful to know. My wife, while I was in graduate school, she worked for about a year for a company called American Recreation Products. They made camping equipment and things like that, a lot of which was manufactured in China. And they were very, if I remember correctly, they were vigilant about making sure that the conditions in the factories from which they sourced their stuff were not terrible. I mean, obviously, they're far worse than the conditions in my office right now, obviously. But not sort of sweatshops that get caricatured by people like the Students Against Sweatshops movement and things like that. Where was I going with this? Home Depot, American Recreation Products, So back to Walmart specifically. So I've read and reviewed a number of books about Walmart for a journal called Economic Affairs. In fact, I think they're the journal that's published all my Walmart book reviews. In one of these, it talks about how Chinese factories that are sources of Walmart goods advertise. One of the things they advertise is we will pay you on time. Okay, now so some people think, oh, well, this is horrifying people are using this as a competitive mechanism, but that's part of the effect of Walmart on the contracting environment and part of the effect of Walmart on the world inhabited by very low productivity people in very, very, very poor countries. So the aspects of compensation are not just income, not just working conditions, but also risk. I got an email today saying, you know, the direct deposit has been made to your bank accounts. Okay, so fantastic. I know that I'm going to get paid every 2 weeks by Rhodes College. That's valuable. And this is something, this is one way that firms are competing for good workers is by offering less risk. If I remember correctly, in another one of these books, it talks about some of the cultural norms of Walmart executives who come over and talk about sourcing in places like China. You know, they're not interested in bribes, and they're not interested in you know, being entertained in questionably ethical ways and things like that. And this is one thing that might be changing some of the business culture and some of the places where firms like Walmart do business. Okay. Do you think the role of the internet, so this is from Doug in the chat window, do you think the role of the internet has helped us discover good versus bad corporations in ways our ancestors were unable to do? Also, do you think the libertarian case for more open markets is stronger because of such available knowledge? Okay, so yes, has the internet absolutely helped us discover, it has absolutely helped us root out good and evil. I think there's no question. There is a much better, the information environment is much better than it used to be. Do you think the libertarian case for more open markets is stronger because of such available knowledge? I'm going to say yes, and I'm going to say no. Yes, because according to the sort of very narrow model of competitive markets that is popular in neoclassical treatments, you know, we have much better information and therefore a far lower probability of information-related market failure. So a lot of people say, oh, well, therefore we don't need as much regulation because we have much more competitive markets for information. I think that the Austrian perspective or the market process perspective would say, well, no, in fact, actually the case for more open markets is, you know, it might actually be, well, I'm not going to say weaker, but it remains unchanged because the search process itself is what generates the information. The search process itself is what generates the the information that might need that might allow us to even conceive of a market failure. One of the best the best essays I've ever read is by James Buchanan. It's called Order Defines the Process of Its Emergence. It talks about the process itself. So the market process itself is necessary for the emergence of social order. Okay, so Steve Wise to all participants. When various organizations seek to improve conditions and salaries in sweatshops here in Cambodia. Oh, so Steve is in Cambodia, okay. I think I knew that, maybe. The owners close the factories and move to other countries, and a lot of the workers move into human trafficking situations. The people here clamor for the sweatshop jobs. Okay, that's something that can't be underestimated. One of my favorite thinkers on sweatshops is an economist named Benjamin Powell. It's a name that might be familiar to some of you. He's a George Mason PhD. He's kind of part of my cohort of thinkers. He has a book. He's working on a book about the economics of sweatshops, and he points out, and a lot of economists point out, that one of the major problems that emerges, or one of the major problems that we have in the world today, is people in rich countries thinking that that imposing working conditions in poor countries will in fact actually help those workers. Well, no. What we do probably when we say when we impose labor standards in different countries, we create more child prostitutes, and that I think is a hideous moral crime. Let's see here. Okay, devil's advocate argument. 100 years ago, we needed big government to watch out for us. Now that we have more knowledge, we don't need it anymore. Well, in fact, there's a case to be made for that. And in fact, one of my friends from graduate school, a scholar named Mark Law at the University of Vermont, has done some work. He was actually a student of Sukho Kim, who I mentioned earlier. He's done some work arguing that the role of regulation in the progressive era was primarily to create new information, to create information and create certification. That's plausible, I think. But it's not, again, it's not entirely clear that that's an unambiguous welfare improvement. Okay, general question, what's the role of geopolitics in the Austrian perspective? From the perspective of Austrian economics as such, you know, if we're talking about just economic theory, well, probably not much. Now, we can talk about the role of international political institutions and how they affect things like international currency markets, how they affect international markets for oil, international markets for politically relevant commodities and things like that. So I would say for purposes of very, very narrow economic theory, probably very small, but for purposes of empirical analysis in the Austrian perspective, it's something that matters a lot. Now, I don't think that's to say that there are exceptions to the law of comparative advantage. I mean that's absolutely not the case. I don't think that international geopolitics change anything theoretically. They do, however, change things empirically. Peter, do you have anything to add to that? Oh, Peter's no longer with us, Peter's no longer listed as a panelist. Okay, we've got a couple of minutes left. If anybody has any other questions. Let's see here. Okay, yeah, I think I offended him with the Naomi Klein comment. Yeah, probably so. I don't have tenure yet, so this is actually a problem. Okay, are we going to be tested on this? Okay, you will have the option of taking an exam that should be, it'll be a short exam, it'll be a multiple choice exam, it'll be primarily a pass-fail exam. You will have the option of being tested on the lectures, And that will be available very, very soon. You'll hear from Doug when the lecture is complete, and then, or excuse me, when the exam is complete, and then when things are finally due. Let's see, I do reserve the right to ask a question based on some of our discussion and things like that, but most of it will be directly from the lectures. Other questions? Okay, impression, equated capitalism with freedom and communism, some kind of slavery or coercion. Give a more detailed explanation. Okay, so in this case, I'll refer you to Peter's lecture in which he defines the differences between capitalism, socialism, and interventionism. This is actually an interesting question to ask because Noam Chomsky is speaking at Rhodes 1 week from tomorrow. And one of the questions I hope to be able to ask him is, how do you define capitalism? Do you define socialism? How do you define democracy? What makes these undesirable, or what makes them desirable? So in the case of capitalism, I define capitalism, and I think Peter defines capitalism, as basically private property and voluntary exchange. Communism or socialism is common ownership of property or surrogate ownership of property by the state or by a small group of individuals, and involuntary exchange. Let's see. I think my lectures for my course, Capitalism and Socialism, will probably be I don't know if those are available now. I'm going to email Danny Sanchez and see if you can get some of that information. Okay, what does the exam serve for? Okay, so what is the exam for? First of all, if you just want to take it, it's all yours. Also, I know that some people are getting credit from institutions of higher education, you know, like pass-fail credit for getting an hour of college credit for doing this, and the exam will be there so they can credibly go for the credit. Okay, not sure I buy your explanation for high executive salaries despite corporate poor performance. Okay, one consideration is relationships with board of directors. Yes. Okay, that is absolutely true. Shareholders do have relatively little power over executives and boards of directors. In that case, given that we have, I'll give it one more minute. I know that there are a lot of great lectures by a scholar by the name of Peter Klein that are available on Mises.org, where I think he actually talks about market discipline, what's called the Burley Means Problem, and separation of ownership and control. So I think, if I remember correctly, there's a Rothbard graduate seminar on man economy and state and power and market that I attended as a graduate student, and which Peter was one of the faculty members, and for which my notes are currently sitting on my bookshelf. I think he talked about this in one of his lectures. I'm pretty sure that a version of that lecture is available somewhere online. Maybe not the one that I sat in on many moons ago as a graduate student, but perhaps a more recent version. Let's see here. Okay, so communism and socialism will claim that freedom is an end as well. Okay, yes, but they're using it, I think what they do in that case is they equivocate on the meaning of freedom. So when I talk about freedom, I generally mean what's called negative liberty. So basically, freedom from people infringing on my rights. When other people talk about freedom, they're probably talking about positive freedom or positive liberty, basically freedom to do a bunch of things. Or we talk about Franklin Roosevelt's four freedoms. One of them was freedom from want. So this again, I think, is where we have to be very, very careful about making absolutely certain that we're clear on what we mean when we say capitalism, when we say socialism, when we say democracy, when we say freedom. Okay, so with that, I have taken an additional 2 minutes of your time, I think. I appreciate everyone's comments, everyone's questions, everyone's feedback. If you have any questions at all, shoot me an email, shoot Professor Klein an email. Thank you all for participating, and I hope to see you either, virtually or in flesh and blood at some point. Thank you all, and good night.